Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema. Hello everybody and welcome to Writers on Film. My name is John Bleasdale. I am a film critic and writer, and today I am going to be talking to Nancy Schoenberger, who is the author, along with her partner Sam Kashner, of the biography, the joint biography, Furious Love, Elizabeth Taylor, Richard Burton and the Marriage of the Century. It's a wonderful read. It's a book that I've been meaning to read for a long time, and I was so pleased to talk to Nancy about the book. One word of warning, we did have some technical issues because the weather situation, as anyone in Europe will know, is not particularly good. So the internet was down and I had to do the interview via my phone. And so that decreases the audio quality somewhat. And there was a slight time lapse as well. So we over-talk each other a little bit in a way that I couldn't remove. So I've tried to fix that as much as I can. But the conversation is so good that I'm sure those minor inconveniences will not impair your enjoyment in any way whatsoever. So, if you enjoy the episode, please remember to like, review, spread the word across the social media landscape. But before you do any of that, enjoy. And you will, I promise you, you will enjoy this conversation.
First of all, I'm so delighted to hear that you're such a fan of Richard Burton, because I am too, as is my spouse and sometime writing partner. We originally wanted to write a book about Richard, although, there, as you mentioned, there's been a couple of biographies already. The biggest, maybe Melvin Bragg's, which included a lot of Richard's writings in his diaries, which we drew upon, of course. But, you know, when you go into the publishing world, well, no, can't you write about Burton and Taylor? That's what people wanted to read about. And so, well, why not? That was a fascinating part of cultural history, sort of the beginning of the paparazzi era. And they were, you know, they were so famous. It was an extraordinary, for them, 13 years all told. So that's what we do. We expanded the book and came up with this idea of just writing about their romance and two marriages. But Burton is just, I still consider him, you know, one of the, if not the most compelling actors of the 20th century. His voice, people talk about his voice, that Welsh voice, so well trained is poetry. In fact, somebody, I think it was Emlyn Williams, described Burton as a boxing poet because he had both qualities. He had this love of poetry, love of literature, love of writing. He really wanted to be a writer. He was always a little bit embarrassed about prancing around in tights on stage, but you know, he was a greatly gifted actor. So that, and that's where the money was, certainly not in poetry. But anyway, for all those, you know, and he also wanted to, he was a rugby player. So he was an athletic fellow and a poetic fellow and a fellow of great passions. And, you know, the combination of all of those things made him such a compelling actor.
I wonder as well today that, because you look back at those actors like Richard Burton, to some degree, Anthony Hopkins.
Another Welsh.
Yes, exactly. I mean, Patrick Stewart from Yorkshire, Ian McKellen from Lancashire. And they're all these sort of regional, mainly working class voices. And nowadays we have Benedict Cumberbatch.
Yes, I like him too, but that's a different kettle of fish. The actors you mentioned, they bring a kind of roughness, a kind of virility, a different kind of experience to their acting roles that, you know, is irresistible to a lot of people, including me. You know, Burton was. That was not his given name. He was born Richard Jenkins, the 11th of 12 children. And his mother died when he was two. But later in life, when he was a young teenager, he was taken in by a teacher and a BBC commentator and theatrical sort named Philip Burton. And he took Richard in as his ward and gave him his name, hence he was Richard Burton instead of Richard Jenkins. But he trained him. He trained him to speak. He had great material to work with. But if you want to get a sense of what that was like for young Richard Jenkins, see his first major role, film role, in Emlyn Williams' The Last Days of Doll Wynn, which is a delightful movie. And he's wonderful as a young country boy who wants to learn English. I think it is set in Wales. So he's a young Welshman, trying to learn English, trying to improve his voice. And so he goes out into the dales and, you know, he speaks at the top of his voice and yells and screams at the wind and all of that to strengthen and improve his voice and to learn English. And that's what Richard Burton did. So with some actors, there's an eerie quality that the movies, their public lives, their movies tap into the lives that they were living. And I think it begins for Burton with The Last Days of Doll Wynn. And there's a very touching scene where he's trying to learn English and a very pretty upper-class English woman comes into the shop where he's working and he tries to impress her with English, but he gets it all wrong and he's so abashed. That's Burton, that you know, wanting to impress, wanting to master English, attraction to pretty women, et cetera, et cetera. So start with the last, if those of you who don't know his career, start with The Last Days of Doll Wynn, which was, by the way, in my view, remade as Local Hero decades later, the Burt Lancaster.
Is that an official?
Notice, but it's the same story as a little small town invaded by a corporation who wants to, in Doll Wynn, they want to flood the valley and they want to buy everybody out. And you'd think that the villagers would really protest that, but no, they say, okay, let's do it. So until things turn around, but it's the same plot, we'll put it that way.
And of course, I mean, one of the things that he had, as well as this wonderful voice, was this prodigious memory for poetry. And it must have been at this stage in which he acquired that, because it was Philip Burton's sort of influence.
Well, even more amazing that he had that memory for so long, despite his prodigious drinking habits, which usually, you know, memory's the first thing to go, but it didn't seem to impact his memory. I think he did start, he loved his fellow countryman, Dylan Thomas, and the poetry of Dylan Thomas, and he knew Dylan Thomas, and he made recordings of, and also appeared in Under Milkwood and filmed it with Elizabeth Taylor later on. The poetry came to him at an early age as an early love, and I think that stayed with him. And he memorized them. So maybe that helped to develop that extraordinary memory.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, there are moments in your book where you talk about him reciting, like, sonnets backwards as a way of, winning.
That's right, I'd forgotten that. He did that at, where was it? Maybe it was at the Old Vic when Winston Churchill was in the in the audience. He wanted to impress it. But what an amazing family he had. And so I guess part of that is his DNA. Who knows where it came from? But that served him well, obviously, as an actor, as a stage actor. And the fact that the alcohol didn't erase that, it's always amazing to me. He had incredible vitality and strength. And I think that came through with all of his abilities. But then, you know, you reach a point where the alcohol wins and then things start to go.
Absolutely. And the alcohol began quite early as well. It was part of the culture of the village. His father was an alcoholic. Maybe because of that culture as well, it was also something that he always kind of denied. He was sort of like, well, no, I'm a heavy drinker, but I'm not really an alcoholic.
Well, you're exactly right. It was part of the culture. It was part of the small, you know, Welsh mining town of Pontredyfen. It was a mark of masculinity. You know, men drank. Men who worked in the mines, which was certainly not an easy way to make a living, they came out and they went to the taverns and they drank. And this was, there's even, I don't remember who first said it, but never trust a man who doesn't drink. That was sort of the mentality that Burton grew up with. And it wasn't looked upon as a, you know, pathology back in the day in this small town and growing up in the, you know, mid 20th century. So the fact that it was accepted part of culture, that it was a mark of masculinity, and that the habit itself is so, you know, takes hold and becomes an addiction. Those are the three things that kept Richard drinking. And Elizabeth, too. Elizabeth, you know, she became addicted to prescription drugs, but she was also a very strong drinker and she could hold it. Burton was amazed that she could drink most of his buddies under the table. And that was one of the many things he loved about her.
Yeah, she had a prodigious, I mean, in
she
a way.
Indeed. She was one of the first celebrities to go to the Betty Ford Clinic later on in life after she and Burton divorced. But Burton did become sober at different parts of his life. I shouldn't be telling this tale out of school because the Taylor people hated this little story. But when Richard would try to get sober during their marriage, she was known to say to him on some occasions, "Oh, Richard, you're so boring when you're sober." So, you know, he didn't really have a lot of, at first, he didn't really have a lot of support from Elizabeth to try to get sober.
You really get the feeling that they facilitate each other's drinking. There's no
they did.
There's
that
no
was
way
one of the many
can
things that kept them together. I mean, in a way, they had both met their match, Burton and Taylor, Taylor and Burton, and they, you know, they performed in they made 11 films together, from the ridiculous to the sublime, you know, the whole range, and they did a few things on stage, and then they. After they divorced, they both appeared at Elizabeth's, you know, insistence in Noel Coward's Private Lives, in a production that Elizabeth put on stage and sweet-talked Burton and gave him a lot of money to appear with her. So we can talk about that later. But there are so many things that drew them together besides just animal passion and these two beautiful people. But alcohol was part of it. Burton said alcohol was the rocket fuel that, you know, drove our marriage. Unfortunately, that has an early sell-by date. You know, that can't last long.
it tends to explode sometimes and blow the rocket up with it.
And the interesting thing about Elizabeth Taylor was she always loved danger and excitement, and she loved to provoke Richard. She said, when I could get Richard mad, it's like atom bombs going off. She loved that passion. And so drink was a part of all that. Later on, they became known as the Battling Burtons. And a lot of this was Elizabeth wanting excitement, you know, wanting to see Richard really blow his top. So that was part of their marriage, too.
Roll a hand grenade into the party and see what happens.
Exactly. Yes. Well, you know, Taylor is so interesting. She is one of these rare women who was born to rule. You've heard that expression, short women rule. And she could do it because she was a beloved international movie star at the age of 12 when she was in National Velvet. And she was perfect for that because she could ride a horse and she was English. Mm-hmm. Those are the first two criteria that they wanted. And she's charming in that. But that made her a star at MGM. It gave her a lot of power and clout at MGM. And so by the age of 12, she ruled the roost. So who's gonna partner with her? You know, she's always going. I mean, she's this incredible beauty and very alluring personality, but she's always going to rule the roost. She was just born to it, and then, you know, achieved it. But also, you know, it was thrust upon her, and she grabbed it. She grabbed the reins. She once told Louis B. Mayer off when she was a little girl. When Mayer, the head of MGM, insulted her mother. you know, her mother was kind of a stage mother back then. She said, "Don't talk to my mother that way." And he backed off because he knew this was his prize, you know, product here, Elizabeth Taylor. And from the age of 12 to tell off a major studio head and get away with it, she ruled.
Yeah,
and so, you know, people make fun of her that she had 8 marriages to 7 husbands, but who's going to stay? Who's going to keep up with her? So we felt that with Burton, she met her match, someone who was not as famous yet, but in England, in the, you know, in theatrical circles on stage, he was, you know, the heir to Olivier and Gielgud. And she considered him a greater actor than she was. And in some ways, I mean, certainly he's a theatrical actor. I actually agree with that assessment. But after they were married, she said, "Oh, please call me Mrs. Burton. I'm just a bride, but my husband is a great actor." She had very little vanity for a woman with kind of preternatural beauty and, you know, strong acting talent and amazing presence on screen. She didn't have any personal vanity. She was very smart, very shrewd. She could sum people up like that. And when she met Richard, this was a guy who could stand up to her and equal her, and in her view, in some areas, out surpass her. So, you know, what's not to like?
I mean, it's amazing that they're coming from these two different places as well. There's a theatre meets Hollywood. He'd already gone to Hollywood, but he'd gone as a little bit of a rough diamond and he'd been a bit obnoxious, and his first films had not been... Well, Hollywood really didn't know what to do with them. I mean, I've watched all of his early films and, you know, I've watched them as a Burton completist rather than somebody, you know, they're not great, are they?
No.
My Cousin Rachel, maybe.
Yes, well, and that was his first Academy Award nomination. He was nominated 7 times, never won. Although, in my view, he should have won for playing George in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. That's just a searing performance. But anyway, yes, they didn't know what to do with him. And in one of those, and his first attempt to conquer Hollywood, which didn't really get him anywhere, he did run across Elizabeth Taylor at a party given by Gene Simmons. He was kind of struck by her beauty, but she knew his reputation as a womanizer preceded him, and she wasn't going to give into that. So she just snubbed him, and he noticed that he was being snubbed. That was their very first years later, they would meet on the set of Cleopatra. And that also began with each of them, you know, trying to ignore or put down the other. Both were aware of their reputations. And, you know, she said, "I'm not going to be another notch on his belt." So she resisted him at first, and he insulted her. I won't say what he called her, but it's in all the books, Miss Blank. But he was interested in her at first. I mean, he was struck by her beauty, but he was interested in her at first because he thought, "Aha, if I, you know, connect with Taylor, I can start. I could get the big film career that I want that had eluded him so far." You're right; it eluded him so far. So ambition as well as sort of passion started that romance, and then it became like he's got hold of the tiger and he can't let go. It became impossible to a life passion.
And they're both married at this point. In fact, Taylor's been married several times. Burton's married, has a sort of long-standing, not only a sort of a marriage in which there's a certain arrangement has been made, shall we say.
Yes, that's right. So Burton was married to his first wife, Sybil Burton, another girl from a Welsh girl. You know, we had interviewed the late Robert Hardy when we were researching this book over 10 years ago. He was wonderful. And he loved Burton. And they were together at Oxford as young men. And he fought, and they also were co-starred in the Spy Who Came In from the Cold. So he knew Richard from an early age. And he also knew Sybil Burton. And she was a wonderful, wonderful woman. People just were drawn to her. And that was a good, solid marriage. But here's this, you know, the swaggering, handsome, passionate Welshman, Burton, who's being lauded on the stage. And women came his way, and he didn't step out of the way. They did have an arrangement that he could have his dalliances, but he said, "I'll never leave you. Just allow me my little side things." And the side things included like Claire Bloom, you know, some very major, fascinating actresses. But they did have an arrangement. So Burton was married to Sybil Burton. And of course, Elizabeth Taylor was married at that time to Eddie Fisher because she had a horrible early marriage to Conrad Hilton, the heir to the hotel empire. And he was just one of these little rich, clueless brats who physically abused her. That marriage lasted, I think her mother had wanted her to marry money. So she did, but that didn't. And then she married, went in the opposite direction and married a man 20 years her senior, the actor Michael Wilding, wonderful, charming English actor, who, you know, looking at it from the outside, it looks like she married her father. He was closer in age to her father, you know, a kind of elegant and charming Englishman. Elizabeth's family were raised in England, although they were from Ohio. They were Americans. Oh, not Ohio. Was it Ohio, Kentucky? I don't remember now. But anyway, Kentucky, I think. So that marriage produced her two sons. And then I always felt a little sorry for him because he captured this amazing prize, Elizabeth Taylor. But he'd been a promising and well-liked actor in England. When he moved to Hollywood, you know, they didn't gravitate towards him. And the best he could do is he became a casting agent. So his career as an actor was over after he married Elizabeth Taylor. But they had two kids. And then that marriage lasted several years, broke up. And she fell in love with Mike Todd, this very dynamic theatrical impresario. And it's just a kind of a vulgarian, you know, powerful, you know, commanded a room, made a lot of money, vulgar, you know, loved to swear, but Elizabeth loved to swear too. So they both also liked to fight. They both liked, you know, they had strong passions. And she thought, oh, this is, I finally have a real passionate love match. And of course, sadly, he died a year into the marriage in a tragic, his plane crashed. I always thought it was ironic that his plane was named the Lucky Liz, but it wasn't very lucky for him. After his death, forgive me for recounting all this marital history, but we'll get to Burton in a second. She married Mike Todd's best friend, Eddie Fisher. And so in a way, it was a marriage of these two people consoling each other on the death of their of Mike Todd. So that lasted a few years. And then Cleopatra. She was the first actress to be paid $1 million for a role, cast as, you know, the famous Egyptian queen. And they started making the film in England, but then moved to Rome, and they switched around directors and actors. They brought in Burton. They bought Burton out of his contract. He was starring on Broadway as King Arthur in Camelot. And, you know, he was wonderful in that role. People just love that play. They loved him in it. And so he said, oh, my chance to be in a big movie with a big movie star. So he left Camelot and went to Rome, and they met. And as I said earlier, neither of them were going to be a notch on the other's belt. But lo and behold, they started an affair, and it became a deep, abiding passion, or at least a passion that lasted, all told, 13 years. That's long in Hollywood standards, 13 years. Forgive me for rambling on and on. There's so much history.
No, it's not a rambling at all. I love it. Yeah, them coming together in Cleopatra is we've had Hollywood scandals before. You know, you've had Ingrid Bergman and Rossellini.
Right, Rossellini, that was a big scandal.
But this is almost like it brings in a new era. It's sort of like they're the kind of just, okay, we're just going to get divorced and go and get married. That's, you know, where this is a love affair, and we're off.
Yes, they didn't do that. They didn't do that discreetly. And that affair, that extramarital affairs on both parts, coincided with the rise of the paparazzi. So they followed them everywhere, and every little tidbit, every photograph they can get of the two of them would be covered on the front pages of magazines. So their little private affair became an international affair. And this is 1961, 62. America was still a fairly puritanical country. And there was a lot of disapproval about her breaking up the marriage of Richard Burton. And, you know, she was disapproved of when she broke up Eddie Fisher's marriage to Debbie Reynolds. So there was, but she survived that little mini scandal. But this was even bigger. And she was condemned on the floor of the Senate. The Vatican called her an erotic vagrant. You know, this took on huge proportions. But you know what? She didn't care. She was in love with Richard, and she wanted to be with Richard. And, you know, she'd fought bigger battles. Well, this was the biggest battle she fought. So she just endured it. And Burton was amazed at her ability to withstand all of this public coverage, most of it negative. Because what did he know? He was this boy from Wales. But she had grown up. She was famous from the age of 12. She was used to having people, you know, thrust cameras in her face and take her picture. She was used to a lot of all that. In fact, Burton once said she had an amazing ability to remain private and public. So she would just go out into a crowd of paparazzi or whatever, and she, like a veil came over her face, and she would give them what they wanted, but it wasn't, she wasn't giving herself away. And Burton didn't have the those skills or that experience. It was really hard on him. He was, you know what? He was a reader. He was an intellectual. He would, he traveled with a suitcase full of all of the plays of Shakespeare. That's who he was. He would rather be sitting in a chair by a fire reading a book than being chased around by a paparazzi. That was a side of him that Elizabeth didn't really share, but she respected it. And it was very hard on him. But somehow he did survive it.
I love how he she gets him a complete library of Everyman classics. And that's like his ultimate dream is to have just as many books as possible.
Yes, he was in heaven. So she understood that side of him and she admired it because she was a very shrewd and smart woman, but she wasn't an intellectual. She wasn't a reader in that way, but she loved those qualities in Burton. In fact, there was a time when Burton was, I guess it was when he went back to Oxford, Dr. Faustus. Here he was in Oxford, and there was some talk that they would hire him to be a teacher there, to be a professor. And he wanted to, that was his dream. He would have loved to have done that. But what was what I found fascinating is that Elizabeth Taylor encouraged it. And she said, well, maybe what I will do is I'll offer a course on the plays of Tennessee Williams, because she was in three of his plays. She was in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, Suddenly Last Summer, and then the camp classic Boom, based on Tennessee Williams, The Milk Train Doesn't Stop Here Anymore. But wouldn't that have been great, fantastic, to take a course on it, those plays with Elizabeth Taylor? Sadly, it didn't happen. But I always thought, wow, what an interesting chapter in their history that would have been.
And we already had what their nightlife would look like, because they'd already done it in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf as the academic couple, you know.
That's right. Well, and again, as I mentioned before, this eerie parallel between their movies and their private life, their private lives together. That doesn't always happen, but sometimes it just comes, and you don't know if they're unconsciously choosing that material. But of course they chose Virginia Woolf because it was a huge, huge success on Broadway. And the next step was the movie, who's gonna play those parts. And they were delighted that they were offered the roles. And she herself chose Mike Nichols, a very young Mike Nichols, to be their director. He'd never directed a movie before. He'd from the comedy duo Nichols and May. But he came on and directed them. And that for him was the beginning of a spectacular directing career. And he did, it's a great movie. It's hard to watch. It's really rough. But in it, the two couple, the Martha and George, Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, fight constantly, saying unbelievably cruel things to each other. But you see there's a passion and an enduring love between them. So there's tenderness amongst all of this betrayal and fighting. But this was at a time when they became known as the battling Burtons. You know, they, at mostly at her instigation, they fought. And they, and when they would travel, for example, they always, in England, in London, they'd always stay at the Dorchester. They would frequently reserve the rooms above, below, and on either side of them, so they wouldn't disturb their neighbors. That was how intense their fights were. But she just loved it, and it didn't. That's not what broke them up. That's not what. That was something that she enjoyed, and he was just so enthralled to her. I guess he endured it.
Yeah. And I mean, it's that sort of fiery intensity. I mean, the title of the book, Furious Love, there's that sense of fury is right in there. Talking about their films, it always surprises me because, you know, Burton especially has this reputation as a wasted talent, an actor who never, when you look down his list of films, it always surprises me how many great films there are. That for a wasted talent, he didn't waste much of it.
That's right. Certainly more than a handful of great films and a lot of fun films to watch and a lot of bad films, but that's true of any actor's career. People love to talk about the wasted talent, but he worked up until the end of his life. Ironically, his last movie was 1984, the adaptation of the George Orwell novel. And that was the year he died, 1984. And you can see he's a small role playing the sort of the Grand Inquisitor who tortures, I've forgotten the character's name, is it Wilson? But he...
Winston Smith, yeah.
Winston, yes. He tortures him with his questioning and confuses him. And it's classic Burton. Here he is at 58 old because of his lifelong drinking, white haired, that face, which was always haunted, even more haunted, yet still sort of very attractive and compelling. And that voice is still there. And that look on his face behind his eyes of kind of regret and world weariness. It was perfect for the role. And this is our last image we have of him making that film. But he gave a wonderful, wonderful performance. He worked to the end of his life. And as you said, in many terrific films, there was a lot of disappointment and some anger towards him when he left the theater for film stardom. But early on, Olivier had sent a telegram to Burton saying, "Oh, come on, Richard, make up your mind. Do you want to be a great theater actor or a movie star?" And Burton shot back, "Both." But and he did achieve both. But there was a certain amount of anger that he left the stage and all that promise as a really great Shakespearean actor to be in. And he ended up being an action hero. He ended up being in Where Eagles Dare and Rommel and, you know, various things that didn't so much make use of his voice as much as it make use of his ability as a, you know, as an action figure. So here you take this great Shakespearean trained actor and you turn him into an action figure. But that's Hollywood, right? That's where the money was. So there was a certain point in his marriage to Elizabeth where he began making more money than she did. And that was a sort of turning point too.
And I mean, the films they make together, I have a lot of time for even the disasters, but the great ones, Taming of the Shrew is wonderful.
I do too.
You know,
it is wonderful.
VIPs, I have a lot of time for. I mean, I know but it's very of its time. You very much feel like you're understanding something about the time that you just don't, you've never really understood before.
Yeah, in a way, you're time traveling to watch those films. I'm glad you like them. I like The Sandpiper, which people made fun of and it got terrible reviews. It did pretty good box office. But looking back at it, it was a very smart, moving film about an illicit love affair between a married man and a woman, an unmarried mother with a past, and set in what was then kind of like a pre-hippie enclave in Big Sur. And then, of course, Burton plays tortured figures so well. And he's a reverend head of a boys' school who leaves his wife for Elizabeth Taylor, and is torn up by guilt. As I said, he does guilt and torment very, very well, and he does it beautifully in The Sandpiper. So if you don't know that movie is really, to your audience, that movie is worth another look at. Same as the VIPs. I think there are a lot of great moments in that movie as well. Again, Burton suffers magnificently trying to hold on to his, as a wealthy tycoon, trying to hold on to his trophy wife who's about to leave him for another man. But you're right, the costumes, look how easy and glamorous air travel was back in the 60s. So it's so interesting to see all of that. And they're playing versions of themselves, as they did in so many of their movies. Boom, the adaptation of Williams, Tennessee Williams, The Milk Train Doesn't Stop Here Anymore. It's such a weird movie. It's John Waters' favorite movie, and it's just pure camp from beginning to end. They're totally miscast as the lead characters, and they were drinking throughout the whole movie. So at one point, there was an accident in the trailer, and all of this, they were drinking Bloody Marys. That was the drink of choice because you get the vitamins from the tomato juice. So they thought that was a healthy alternative. And at one point, there was a mishap in their trailer, and a whole thing of Bloody Mary spilled out. And so this red substance was pouring out of their people thought, "Oh my God, they killed each other." But so there was a lot of goings on while they made Boom. And it's just a crazy, silly, campy film, but it's fun. It's fun to watch them.
And they're always making, even the campy films, as you say, they're always making them with high quality people. I mean, Joseph Losey directs that. He directs Burton again in the assassination of Leon Trotsky, which, you know, it's I'm not going to make a case for it being a great film, but, you know, you've got Alain Delon in that film. You've got a whole, you know, the stuff going on that's just fascinating.
Well, Elizabeth always commanded the best and she got the best. And to her credit, she wanted to work with Joseph Losey, who was an avant-garde director, not really in her, you know, not really who she was, but she didn't want to just make Hollywood movies. She wanted to expand her abilities and be in more art, quote unquote, arty or artistic films. And they didn't always work out. She did The Secret Ceremony, which didn't get very good reviews, and Boom, and not among her best movies, but still fascinating. And it's to her credit that she wanted to expand what she could do and work with edgier, more avant-garde directors than she had. She was very loyal to directors. She was responsible in part for bringing Joe Mankiewicz in to finish directing Cleopatra. And he sort of took over the production, rewrote the script. He did the whole thing on amphetamines because it was such a huge production. And so it has a kind of amphetamine grandiosity to it. But she had worked with him in Suddenly Last Summer. And she's wonderful and compelling in that movie. So she knew quality. She knew and George Stevens, who directed her in Giant, she wanted to work with him again, and she did. And I forgot which film that was. But she was very loyal to the directors who she could flourish with.
Oh, I think it was his very last.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Film, wasn't it? He was maybe her and Frank Sinatra. I forget the title though. But John Huston is another one.
Sorry.
It's okay. I'll just drop a clip of my voice saying the title here at this point in the conversation.
The only game in town.
John Huston. She both of them worked separately with John Huston. There's Night of the Iguana and Reflections in the Golden Eye.
Yes, that's right. Night of the Iguana. Another Tennessee Williams play, you know, adapted into film with John Huston. That's a wonderful movie. And again, he plays a defrocked priest. He's very good at playing defrocked priests, men who are, you know, brilliant, deep, poetic, but racked with guilt. So that really was a specialty of Burton's. And I think it reflected a lot of who he was. And Elizabeth came along to the set. It was set in Puerto Vallarta, Mexico, and was there just sort of, you know, enjoying being not working, but being with Richard, with a really wonderful cast. So that was a very happy time of their life together. They ended up buying a place in Puerto Vallarta and were responsible in part for turning this little sleepy Mexican village into a tourist attraction, which it is now. So that was really a good part in their life. They loved just touring the little Mexican villages. And Richard Burton, who, you know, very good writer, wrote a piece for one of the ladies' magazines about being in a little village in Mexico when a traveling circus came through. And there was a knife thrower, and the impresario asked for volunteers to come up and, you know, have a knife thrown at her. So she did. Elizabeth said, no, no, I want to do it. She went up there, and Burton watched while this little local traveling circus knife thrower threw knives at his wife, missing her face by inches. But that, she didn't flinch. This is what I mean. Elizabeth was drawn to adventure and drawn to risk and was excited by it. So of course I can see her doing that. Of course she would do that. There's a wonderful story that one of her associates told us when we embarked on this book many years ago, that later on in life, long after Burton had gone, and she was in her 70s. She'd always had some health problems. She had injured her back as a young girl, probably in a horse riding accident. She's always on painkillers anyway. So she was in a wheelchair at the time, but she was in Hawaii and she wanted to swim with the sharks. So she goes to she arranges it. She gets to the dropping off point. She's lifted out of her wheelchair and put into a shark's a cage. To go down and be amongst all these sharks in her shark cage. And the diver said, oh, by the way, Miss Taylor, remove all your jewelry because they're so glittery and shiny. They're just going to attract the sharks and make them go mad. And she said to them, oh, I thought that was the point. So that's her. She just was drawn to danger. She had to have things flashing around her. She grew up that way.
Yeah, in the midst of the maelstrom. And it's almost like there's a Midas touch quality to them, that in terms of both, everything they touch turns to some form of gold, but it also destroys things that they want. They want that Mexican village because it's quiet. And then when they go back, it's been, you know, they're famous there as well.
Yes, exactly. At one point, they lived on their yacht. They bought a grand yacht. I think it had 14 rooms and they had a crew of 9. They called it the Kalisma, named after their children. And they spent at least 2 years just, you know, yachting around the Mediterranean from one fancy port to another. And we determined that at that point in their lives, they were too famous to live on land. They had to just stay on that, their little protective cocoon of that yacht. So you're right, in a way, their story is a story of what it means to get everything you want in life. And huge amounts of it. Yes, for a while it was glamorous, glorious, the wealth, the attention, the artistic opportunities, the passion, the love. It was all there. But again, be careful what you wish for, because, you know, you can live under that kind of scrutiny constantly. It was very hard on Burton, as I said earlier, harder on him than it was on her. And then, of course, the thing that helped fuel their passion and their, you know, their fights and their love affair was the alcohol. And of course, you know, that might get you started to begin with, but it takes its toll. And it really took its toll, particularly on Burton. Elizabeth was able to get sober and, you know, kick her addiction to prescription painkillers. You know, she did all that through the Betty Ford Clinic and she stayed sober. But Burton tried and that's what defined what destroyed their marriage. He became just so wounded and rendered. He really could barely work. When he appeared in The Klansman with Lee Marvin, the makeup man came in one morning. The director said, would you go ahead and take a look at Burton's makeup? And the makeup man was, oh, yeah, he for a man who in the film who plays someone at the brink of death, he looks great. And the makeup man said, yes, but I haven't touched him yet. I haven't put any makeup on him at all. So that was how he looked, The Klansman. He, you know, the trembling. Interestingly, it was that trembling that first softened Elizabeth Taylor's heart. Because on the set of Cleopatra, she, you know, I'm not going to be a notch in his belt, but the next day, practically on the set, she walked in and his hands were trembling because he was hungover. And that endeared him to her because she saw how vulnerable he was and how human he was. And I guess it was maybe the siren call of two heavy drinkers, who knows? But that it first endeared her to him. And then at the end of their marriage, their first marriage, they couldn't live together. They couldn't make it work with all that.
I get the feeling as well that as it goes towards the end of their romance, he wasn't somebody who necessarily, when he did get sober, and first of all, it did, you know, he wasn't in a relationship where that was ever going to be successful. And secondly, he didn't seem to necessarily enjoy being sober with her. You know, it was like, you know, he didn't enjoy parties when he was sober. He didn't enjoy, you know, he would much rather have just been drinking all that time.
Yes, it was a big part of their marriage. It was one of the things that kept them together. Burton, for his credit, for a guy who was known as a womanizer earlier in his life, he was faithful to her for all those years. And I think it became also the only way he could live with that level of scrutiny. And I think he was a very private, a guy who loved his privacy. And yet she always had to have an entourage. She couldn't be alone. She grew up, you know, as a young actress, as a child actress, surrounded by makeup people and studio people and publicists, blah, blah, blah. So that's how she lived her life. She usually had an entourage of 8 to 10 people wherever she went. And that wasn't something that Burton could do easily. And I think alcohol made it easier for him to endure that aspect of their married life. I was going to say that is the fact that his father was an alcoholic and it was part of the culture he grew up in. So it took a while before it dawned on him that this is really a problem.
Towards the end as well, he after he he did stray, you know, he did break his vows, so to speak.
On the set of Clansman and Bluebeard, there were some suspicions of his dalliance with Alain Delon's wife at the time. Anyway, but that was towards the end of, that was very much towards the very end of their first marriage, which lasted 10 years.
And absolutely.
Then divorced, and then they remarried in Botswana, and that second, that remarriage lasted a year. And they were together for 2 years before they married. So Burton says, our grand love affair lasted 13 years, including both marriages and the 2 years before they married. It's an unlucky number.
Lucky Liz as well. You know, I mean,
like all the lucky these, Liz. God.
There is a sense as you come towards the end of the book, a period of history has passed by as well, that things have happened which, you know, could only have happened in that period. We might have Brangelina, we might have other sort of similar relationships that fill the newspapers and the gossip magazines, but nothing quite as grand as this has happened since.
You're absolutely right. It was very much of its time, and it was a confluence of the rise of paparazzi culture, the Puritanism of America, and I guess England to some degree, you know, hitting this, the fact of extramarital affairs and grand passion, and something has to give. So all, you know, the lack of other distractions. Now there's so many things that can occupy your time. Just, you know, all the media we have and all the different electronic devices we have, that we don't give that much, maybe for the good of it, we don't give that much attention to what the celebrities are doing. But in its day, you know, they were it. They had symbolic power. They had emotional power. They had cultural power. And you're right. I can't see. I mean, before that, there was the, you know, the Duke and Duchess of Windsor, that scandal. That was that, you know. But back then, what did you have? You had newspapers. That's about it. You had newsreels. But that was it. Now there's so many ways to distract yourself that we don't give that kind of importance to any one celebrity so much. Maybe the Kardashians. I don't know. but yes.
I mean,
their movies. And throughout all of that, incredible cultural upheavals that all happened at the same time, they produced some magnificent works of art. I mean, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf is their best film and one of the best films of that era. And they are just relentless and searing and so honest and unforgettable. It actually hurts my heart that Burton didn't get an Academy Award for that, because he was so moving, and just the whole range of the emotions that he expresses. And there's a kind of fluidity and depth to that portrayal that just breaks your heart. And for that not to have been recognized with the highest honor of Hollywood, it's just, but I think there was always a little bit of resistance against Richard in Hollywood, even though he made a lot of money for them in his more action-oriented films. A little bit of resistance. One, he stole their darling. He married their darling child star, Elizabeth Taylor, and took her to England and got her in some of these movies that they wouldn't have approved of, like the Joseph Losey movies. So he was always seen a little bit as an interloper in Hollywood, where she was their darling, you know, from the age of 12.
And he didn't like living there as well. That was sort of like, he wasn't someone who'd establish himself there.
That's right. He was much happier in Europe, happier in England, and happier in Wales when he was, you know, visiting. And when he married his fourth wife, Sally Hay, they moved to Switzerland, and he had a very peaceful life there, but it wasn't very long, because he then died of a cerebral brain hemorrhage at the age of 58. And Elizabeth Taylor was asked not to attend his funeral in Switzerland, Seligny, because she was afraid it would turn the funeral into a paparazzi, you know, mayhem. So she didn't, but she went later privately to Burton's grave. And there was this feeling that this had really been the love of her life. And I think it was. I mean, she wasn't with Mike Todd long enough. That marriage lasted only a year before his untimely death. But with Burton, they went through every possible scenario, range of emotion, you know, depth of attachment. I mean, that was for her, who tended to dominate any scene she was in. She had met her equal.
Absolutely. Yes. And before we finish, I'm so aware there are so many films that we haven't mentioned, and so many people and personalities who light up your book who we haven't mentioned. Montgomery Clift we haven't mentioned. We haven't mentioned Equus, which was a wonderful sort of return to form for Burton in the stage. And one of my favorite films. That would be one of one of the films I would argue he deserved an Oscar for as well.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
And I also think there are some films that are kind of maybe well worth reassessing. I really love Villain and Medusa Touch, for instance. I think they're very generic and all the rest of it, but they're really good at what they do. So I wanted to ask you, what's your favorite Burton? What's your favorite Liz Taylor film? They don't have to be in both. They don't have to be a pairing necessarily.
Well, at the top of that list would be, as I mentioned, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf with both of them. But apart from that, I think Elizabeth Taylor is wonderful in Suddenly Last Summer, which is such a strange play. It was a one-act play, you know, turned into a film, adapted for film by Gore Vidal, no less. And we actually spoke to him years ago before his untimely, well, I guess it wasn't an untimely death. He was well on in years. But and he said, here's this movie about homosexuality, cannibalism, frontal lobotomies. And it was a huge success in, you know, mid-century America. Most Americans have no idea what any of those things even are. But it was just so compelling. Taylor, of course. Catherine Hepburn plays this kind of evil matriarch. Montgomery Clift plays the doctor that she's hired to give Elizabeth Taylor a lobotomy to take out the memory of her of having witnessed the cannibalization of her beloved son. It's just morbid gothic stuff, and yet because of the star power, Joe Mankiewicz directed, it was a huge success. And Gore Vidal, you know, 40 years later, was laughing about that. My God, how did America embrace this movie? I don't think it would have gotten anywhere in today's world with as fractious as we are now. But she's wonderful in that. I'm trying to think of some other films of hers that I really loved. I think she's really good in The Last Time I Saw Paris. So her great films tend to be earlier in her career. And so for Burton, Virginia Woolf, of course, and I think he's wonderful in that small part in 1984. I'm not remembering some of my favorites of his films because I love him in the Last Days of Dolwyn, his first feature film with a major
role. Right.
He's just so touching in that and so compelling. What are some of your favorites of Burton's single films without her?
Certainly those that you've mentioned. I think one of his, I really, really love The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, because I think that's encapsulates what the guilt and the hauntedness.
Yes.
And it's like Richard Burton doing a James Bond movie. It's exactly what you get, you know.
He was considered to be James Bond at some point, but in a way, you're right, he already did it. He did it in Spy Who Came In From the Cold. Yes, he's chilling in that movie. He's so full of self-loathing, you know, guilt. It's a powerful performance. And it's nice to see Robert Hardy in that film as well. Those two played off each other very well. So yeah, he's wonderful in that. And I think he's wonderful in the Sandpipers. As a guilt-ridden priest, but a married Episcopal headmaster who has this illicit affair. He's wonderful in that. I think he's great in The Night of the Iguana. That's where he plays the defrocked priest with a lot of self-awareness.
Absolutely, yes.
And again, he's just, you just can't take your eyes off him. And that's with a fabulous cast with Deborah Carr and Ava Gardner. That's the John Huston directed film. But he just shines in that because he's unforgettable.
Absolutely. It's probably one of his more uncontrolled performances as well. You know, he doesn't have that grip that he usually has on. He relinquishes it purposely in terms of the character.
Yes, and that's something that that's very appropriate for a Tennessee Williams theatrical production. He loves those kinds of doomed tragic characters who will go the whole distance emotionally, and Burton does that.
Absolutely, absolutely. I have one final question for you, Nancy, which is a question I ask all my guests, which is to give me and to give my listeners a recommended film book, a book which you've read and maybe has inspired you, or a book that you just enjoy.
Well, the first biography that I read and loved that made me think, gee, this is a genre I would like to try my hand at, was Gerald C. Clarke's biography of Truman Capote. You know, that's at least 30 years old, but it's just a master of the form. It's so insightful. Great blend of reportage and insight and storytelling. So that's a wonderful book. I mean, there's so many, it's hard to choose. I've been doing a lot of work about Tennessee Williams. His name has cropped up a lot today.
Right.
My most recent book, which came out in April, is about seven actors, actresses, who played Blanche DuBois, perhaps his most famous character from Streetcar Named Desire. So I've been reading a lot about Tennessee Williams. And there's a two-part biography. I love the first part, written by Lyle Leverich. It's called Tom, the Unknown Tennessee Williams. I'm just reading from the cover. That's a wonderful book. I'm looking at Donald Spado's book about Tennessee Williams called The Kindness of Strangers. I'm looking at what's on my table is also fun to read. So, okay, what else do I have? Oh, here's a fun book. Can you see it? Nibbles and Me. This was written by Elizabeth Taylor when she was 14 and published by MGM, or they arranged to have it published. And it's about her lifelong love of animals. It's about her chipmunk called Nibbles. And she wrote it and she illustrated it. And you can even, here she is 14. Can you see that? She already had this preternatural adult face, which is why they didn't really like her as a child actress at Universal when she started, because she didn't have that little cute little girl's face like Shirley Temple. She had the face of a grown woman. So, and that was a little unsettling for people. Mm. But this book is really fun. This is my newest book. It's called Blanche, anyway, about, you know, seven actors.
Excellent.
So... Anyway, does that begin to answer your question?
Yeah, Nibbles at Me has gone top of my reading list now. For the title alone.
You'll have trouble finding it. I love John Huston's memoir. I can't think of the name of it now, but that
that's
a wonderful memoir. And my first biography that I wrote, you know, as a solo author, was called Dangerous Muse, The Life and Times of Lady Caroline Blackwood. And John Huston had lived in Ireland for a while and knew this illustrious Guinness family that Caroline Blackwood had stemmed from. And so that's why I read that book. But I found the whole thing just fascinating. I also Excellent. Loved other recommendations. I loved Patti Smith's first memoir, Just Kids. That's a fabulous book. As is the co-authored book by Keith Richards. What the hell is the name of it? My Life, something like that. That's a really fun, interesting book.
Yeah.
What I loved about... I'm running long, but one of the things I loved about Patti Smith's book was it opens when she tells the story of being a little girl, like 5 or 6, and her mother taking her to Central Park, and she sees this beautiful creature on the lake, just incredibly beautiful, with a long white neck and beautiful feathers, and says, "Mommy, what is that?" And her mother, oh dear, that's a swan. And at that moment, she said, there's a word for that kind of beauty. So the word and the image fused in her mind. And that was the beginning of her life as a poet. So I thought that was just a wonderful telling of when those things come together, the image and the word come together.
That is beautiful. Yeah, that is beautiful. My daughter has been recommending that book to me for a long time. So I've got to...
It's worth a read, absolutely.
Put it on my to-read. Yeah, very much so. Well, listen, Nancy, thank you so much for talking to me. And thanks so much for the book and the books, because I know you've written lots of books. And this is only one that is hopefully going to start me off on a trail of including your latest.
Thank you.
But thanks so much for talking to me.
Oh, John, my pleasure. I enjoyed this quite a bit. It's so nice to meet another
Excellent.
Person who loves Richard Burton and gets what was so special about him.
So that was my conversation with Nancy about her book, Furious Love, Elizabeth Taylor, Richard Burton, and the Marriage of the Century, which is available wherever good books are sold, including internet sites, I believe. But it's a brilliant tome, really, really great story, packed with anecdotes, and it really makes you think. I think Richard Burton is a figure who deserves to be rediscovered. Elizabeth Taylor, I think her position in the pantheon is much assured, but we need to keep going back to these stars who very much invented what cinema is today, but are in danger of being swept away by such things as streaming, where you don't really have any historical depth to the films on offer. A little thing that I've decided to do in these sort of post-interview sections is just talk maybe a little bit about films I've seen recently. No attempt to review stuff which is being released anywhere or anything like that. Purely my own viewing habits. So I watched a couple... Well, first of all, I watched Fall of the House of Usher, which is the TV show, the Mike Flanagan adaptation of Edgar Allan Poe. And recently I'd also rewatched Roger Corman's Fall of the House of Usher in starring Vincent Price. Which is an old favourite of mine. I love that film. The colours, the set design, the costumes, Vincent Price. It's just all over a superb film. I've not been a huge fan of Mike Flanagan in the past, I must say. At least I didn't like the very first of his series, The Haunting of Hill House. I'm a huge Shirley Jackson fan, and so I found the contemporary setting. I just kind of a little bit like War of the Worlds. I enjoyed the original so much, I think, why don't you just do a period version rather than an updating? I didn't see The Haunting of Bly House, although I will rectify that. I did see Midnight Mass, which I thought was a big improvement on The Haunting of Hill House. And Fall of the House of Usher is my favourite so far of the ones that I've seen. I thought it was absolutely excellent. A really interesting postmodern take on Edgar Allan Poe with lots of wonderful references and a brilliant topicality and sly humour. It was the funniest version that I've seen. It was really, I mean, somebody described it recently on the internet as spooky Succession, and I think that is a worthwhile description. It was really good. The performances throughout, Bruce Greenwood, Carla Gugino, I think her name is pronounced, Mary McDonald, they were all great across the board. I really like who else was in it that I particularly Willa Fitzgerald, who plays a young Madeline Usher. I think she's a cracking actress, really, really played her part well. The other things that I've seen recently, well, on the other scale, Evil Dead Rise, the Lee Cronin next chapter, if you like. There's already been a remake of Evil Dead, and now this is another one. This did not impress me, I'm afraid. Everything looked like a movie. Whereas Evil Dead, you know, wasn't exactly Ken Loach social realism. There was a sort of grunginess to it, which made you feel like somehow this film had been, that the actors had been hurt in the making of this film. You know, there was some sense of danger to it. There was even the plasticine monsters. By that time, you were so into it, it made sense. Evil Dead Rise has the technical acuity and it has the gloss, but it's that very gloss which, to me, takes away from the horror. All the actors, all the characters look like actors playing characters. The dysfunctional family trope, there are just so many tropes in this that you know, everybody has a problem that will come out in the horror somehow. I just found it tedious. And you know, the gross out moments as well just felt like button pushing to me. On the plus side, last night I did watch John Cassavetes, a film I'd never seen before, actually. I've seen a lot of Cassavetes, but this was one that I had just slipped past me. Gloria, a film from 1980, often regarded as his most commercial film. This stars Gina Rowlands as a woman who's basically works for the mob in some capacity. You don't really find this out during the film, and it's never really specified, but from her curious set of skills, I would say it's sort of a button woman, a sort of hit woman of some kind. She plays the title role, and a young boy is placed in her charge after a mafia shooting massacres his family, and despite her
profession, despite the danger that it puts her in, and despite her best inclinations of survival, she somehow decides to take this boy under her wing. It is a remarkable film. It looks amazing. New York in the summer of 1979 looks fantastic. And Gina Roland's performance is pure character driven. It's wonderful. It's full of little gestures, you know, the way she smokes a cigarette, the way her eyes scan a street for danger, the way she stands on a back foot with her, you know, on the back heel, toes tilting up, you know, there's this sort of come and get me stance. It's just phenomenal. The places themselves, the bars, the hotels, the corridors and staircases of crumbling apartment buildings, magnificently filmed, magnificently directed. Music by Bill Conti has this luscious sort of depth to it. Everything in this film it has a depth to it. You know, even just, you know, people getting up in the morning, 8 o'clock in the morning in Brooklyn, you know, you see things. You know, I think it's something that when you watch recent films, you kind of feel you're missing in that no film ever feels like it's being shot somewhere real with real people. And this, you know, if the camera gets on the bus, you feel like you're on a bus with normal people. If we enter a railway station, you feel you're going past people you know, it just feels real. It feels like this is a story that's happening in the world. And it's a generic story. It's a story which is, in some senses, kind of quite, you know, formulaic in the way it you know, a hit woman with a heart of gold, if you like. And the violence bursts in so well and so surprisingly. And I think it's a real feminist film as well, in that it is about a woman with no real maternal instincts. Who is a powerful figure of violence. And every time you think she might be in danger or in some way, you would expect a kind of behavior that would be like a damsel in distress. She doesn't just match the men. She beats them to the ground. She beats them into a pulp. Her attitude, you know, she cries at one of her hitmen that she's going after. She shouts at him, you know, come, you know, she's taunting him, come and try it, you'll love it, she says to him, you know, as she brandishes a gun, you know, you'll love it, come and have a go, you'll love it. It's amazing. Oh, such a good film. 5 stars, definitely, in my book. So if you haven't seen that, pop it on. It's a cracker. I think it's showing. I think it might be showing on Mubi if you have Mubi. I'm not sure what location it would be, but I think it might be showing there. I watched it on DVD anyway, so well worth picking up if you haven't seen it. And if you have seen it a long time ago, it's well worth watching again. Okay, so those are the films that I've watched recently. Oh, there's one final one that's worth a mention. I was over in Britain and I saw the Jimmy Savile docudrama, I guess you would call it, with Steve Coogan in the title role, a sort of role that in a way he kind of had been rehearsing since the 1980s, because he was the voice of Jimmy Savile for Spitting Image, the satirical British TV comedy puppet show. Of course, this is not in any way a comedy. This is a drama. This is a very dark drama, a very dark subject matter of an abusive man who basically got away with it for the whole of his life. There is a sense of punishment, I think, in the idea that he sort of dies a fairly sad and lonely man who's seen his career sort of slide away from him, but then is buried as some sort of national treasure, some sort of great, wonderful guy. So it's a tough watch, but it's really well done. And Steve Coogan is fantastic, as you would imagine him to be. The one piece of criticism I might have for Coogan's performance, and this is a decision, a choice that I'm sure he was well aware of and conscious of, is that he sometimes didn't quite have what I would have thought was, it seems like a small point, but I'll say it anyway, there's a sort of wide-eyed, astonished sort of innocence to Savile's persona which he would then use to dominate and hypnotize a room. And I think Coogan plays him more as a sort of, you know, his eyes are more hooded and he's more, there's almost like you always see the darkness in him, whereas I think there's a little bit of retrospection about that there were moments where he did appear to be sort of innocent, even though now we look at him as one of the most grotesque monsters that Britain has produced. And indeed, you know, I wouldn't dispute that idea. But that well worth seeing. It's a four-part documentary. It's available on iPlayer if you're living in the UK. I'm not sure how you can see it internationally. I was in England, so I got the opportunity to watch it. But yeah, very well worth seeing. Gloria, I would put at the top of the list. Fall of the House of Usher and The Reckoning, amazing. And Evil Dead Rises, you know, approach with caution, but not because it's scary, because it's shite. Okay, that's all from me. Next week we will be talking to Pamela. I will be talking to Pamela Hutchinson about The Red Shoes, and hopefully you will join me. Until then, take care.
It's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.